Thank you. Okay. Let's ask everybody to be seated. All right, let's get started. Hello.
Okay, we're starting.
Thank you. All right, I'm Dr. Daryl Arnett. I went to treatment about 7.5 years ago, and one of y'all, and it's wonderful. God has a great sense of humor, because you know, 7.5 years ago, I thought I was hopeless and had nothing to offer anybody, and really didn't have anything to offer at the time. But with God's help and a lot of people to dig me out of the ruins, I'm happy to say that I went from internal medicine, and God asked me to become an addiction specialist. So we'll get into that in a minute. But I did want to say that this is not a regular SA meeting per se. This is actually a discussion on sex addiction and lust addiction, and that if anyone's uncomfortable with that, please feel free to leave if you're uncomfortable, okay? If you could hit that slide, thank you. Personal experience, I'm president of the Tennessee Society of Addiction Medicine, which is basically just a lot of addiction doctors, but also if there are physicians in the state of Tennessee who are not addiction doctors, but rather need help in regard to anything from alcohol to drug dependence to sex, gambling, steroids, whatever, then you know, our job is to help mentor those people and make sure the people get the care that they deserve. I am certified by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is basically the mechanism by which we get trained. It takes about 3 years to get trained in that. And my office, my primary office, is called Church Street Care. It's about a football throw from Baptist Hospital on Church Street in Nashville, for those in Nashville. And we basically do addiction and mental health and chronic pain syndromes in our office. We have other doctors there also, and we also have master's level therapists in our office to help people. And I'm medical director at New Life Lodge, which is a primary treatment center, and basically that means drugs and alcohol that have not been to a prior treatment center, that's near Dixon, Tennessee. And I'm blessed to be associated with it. They just got ranked the number one treatment center in the United States just 2 months ago. And then I'm also medical director at the Ranch. That's a secondary treatment center, and it's a little complicated, but basically, to make it simple, a secondary treatment center is for people who have already been to a primary treatment center. Perhaps they didn't get all the help that they needed, so they, you know, need some additional work. And the Ranch is a place where you would go from 1 to 3 months to get help for that. And also, it treats conditions that most treatment centers don't treat, and that would include eating disorders such as bulimia or anorexia nervosa. It would also include steroid addiction and sex addiction and gambling addiction. And there are a lot of treatment centers that are primary treatment centers that are really not equipped to handle that. Also, if a patient's in treatment and right toward the end of their graduation time, they give up some major thing and their stint there at the primary treatment center is over, then it's time to go to secondary treatment center because they didn't give it up earlier in their treatment, and you know, they have additional traumas. We do a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder type treatment there at the Ranch too. If you could hit the next, thank you. Defining terms. This is a little bit of a medical talk as opposed to traditional, you know, essay type talks, but I just want to kind of let you know kind of how we approach things in the addiction field, and I'm going to try to keep it in terms that even I would understand. Addiction, the term addiction has been replaced by the term dependence, meaning doctors in addiction don't use the term addiction except to say we're addictionologists. In reality, we use the term dependence instead. And this is one of the reasons why we do this is because it's a less shaming term, and it's also not judgmental. Rather, it's simply stating that we got dependent on something and we need help for that. You know, a typical scenario, as I say, if you're a drug addict, then people's perception in community may be a prostitute who is shooting up heroin and has to keep doing the deal in order to buy her drugs. Well, that's a public perception. Or another perception would be an alcoholic who lives underneath the Jefferson Street Bridge here in Nashville, and he carries a cardboard sign that has written on there, "We'll work for drugs." We'll work for for money. Thanks. And Vietnam vet usually appears on there, and God bless you usually appears at the bottom of that. And so, again, we're trying to get away from that stereotype, because the reality is some of us are Many of us, you know, can own a business or a doctor, judge, lawyer, senator, whatever. It's just there's anybody and everybody. This disease respects nobody. Dependence is defined by set criteria. We're going to go through what those criteria are. But basically, the criteria are identical by the American Society of Addiction Medicine as well as the American Psychiatric Association. And we'll go through that in a moment. Abuse, like if you abuse drugs, as an example, or abuse alcohol, that's a different set of criteria. We're going to kind of go through that in just a moment. And so basically, there's another way of dividing up dependence and abuse, and that is that dependence and abuse disorders are divided into substance disorders and process disorders. And I'm going to make that simple here in just a minute for you. Next slide, please. I apologize for the slide. It's way too complex, but I'm going to go through it slowly. The first thing is that substance dependence. And why am I talking about substance? We're here for SA. Well, substance, what I'm going to do as part of this talk is I'm going to compare substance disorders to process disorders. Okay? And the American Society of Addiction Medicine, the American Psychiatric Association have a lot more experience with substance disorders than they do process disorders. So what we're going to do is we're going to compare for defined terms first, the way they define terms, and then we're going to compare that with process disorders such as sex addiction. Okay. Anyway, it's defined as a maladaptive pattern of substance use. If that isn't a doctor term, I don't know what it is. That's ridiculous. But anyway, you have to have three of the following criteria that we're going to go through here, okay? And it needs to be during the same 12-month period of time. So let's go through those. The first is development of tolerance. And what does tolerance mean? It doesn't mean tolerance for your wife or girlfriend, but rather with substance tolerance, and that is specifically either a need for an increased amount of a substance in order to achieve whatever effect that you're looking for, or if you keep taking the exact same amount of that particular drug, you're going to have a diminished return. Okay. Secondly is the development of withdrawal, and that is characteristic withdrawal syndrome. Well, that's kind of technical, but let me break it down. Withdrawal is real simple. It's sweats and nausea and cramps and diarrhea and tremor and headaches and aches in your joints or muscles. It's also irritability and moodiness and sleep disturbances and depression. So it encompasses a lot of different things. And you kind of hear some of those kind of can relate to us in sex addiction if we're kept away from our drug of choice or our process of choice. So anyway, and the other thing is that you may take closely related substances to avoid the withdrawal. So in other words, if somebody is addicted to a pain pill like OxyContin or something like that, oxycodone or something like that, they may take Lortab instead, and then that, sure enough, that will help relieve their symptoms. They may have to take more of the minor drug, but the point is it does help relieve the withdrawal effects. All right. Number three is the substance is often taken in larger amounts or over a longer period of time than was originally intended. Number four is that there's a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control substance use. And some of this hits, you know, sex addiction very well. Number five, a great deal of time is spent in activities to obtain the substance and use of the substance, or recovering from its effects. Next is important. Social, occupational, or recreational activities are given up or reduced because of the substance use. A lot of other people will notice a change in behavior for someone with substance dependence because they'll see that they're not as involved. They're not showing up to play basketball on Saturday mornings, and they're not inviting people over the house like they used to, and at nighttime they don't seem to go out with the guys anymore, as an example. Number seven, the substance use has continued despite knowledge of having a persistent or recurrent physical or psychological problem as unlikely to have been caused by the substance or made worse by the substance. Now, here's an example, because that's kind of technical too. But continued drinking despite recognizing that I've got a peptic ulcer as a result of my drinking. But I'm still going to go back to drinking if that's what I was addicted to. Next slide, please. Okay, substance abuse. This one's different. The slide looks just as complex, but it's different. So let me break it down for you. It's also a pattern over the last 12 months, and you only have to have one of these criteria. So let's look at them. Number one is recurrent substance use resulting in a failure to fulfill a major role or obligation in your life, which would be work, school, or home. We broke that down into simple things, and that is repeated absences, poor work performance due to substance use, substance-related absences, suspensions, expulsions, DUIs, and neglect of children or wives or significant other. Number two, recurrent substance use in situations in which there is physical hazard. Then that would be a driving while intoxicated or operating a heavy machine or something like that. That could put either others at risk or yourself at risk. Number three is recurrent substance-related legal problems, such as arrest for DUI or under the influence of a substance. And number four would be continued substance use despite having persistent or recurrent social or interpersonal problems caused by the effects of the substance. And that would be like arguments with the spouse about the consequences of intoxication or physical fights. And these symptoms also, at the very bottom, is that these symptoms have never met the criteria for substance dependence. So in other words, you can be abusing a substance, and if I'm addicted to it, under substance dependence, then substance dependence would be the term that we would use in that case if they meet those criteria. Next. Thank you. All right, substance and process disorders. Let's get to the meat of things. Well, I got asked to give this talk to begin with. Substance dependence requires ingestion. So that's going to be things I shoot up, I drink, or I snort. And so that's going to be alcohol and opiates, which are pain medicines, cocaine, methamphetamines, anxiolytics, that means anti-anxiety drugs, our tranquilizers are no way to put that. So, Valium and Xanax and Klonopin and things like that would appear on there. Hallucinogens like LSD, peyote, things like that. Then we've got inhalants, and I just mentioned paint and glue as examples of that. Good old cannabis. And dissociates, and that means that we can take good old cough syrup and take enough of that, and we'll get pretty withdrawn from reality. Well, process disorders require thought processes. Okay, so we're not ingesting things per se, but let's look at it. One would be lust, food, codependency, rage, power, exercise, shopping, phone or TV, and that means we're sitting down at the TV a long period of time, or our wives on the phone. I didn't say that. Do not say that. I've been happily married for 23 years. I better not go there. Work, such as workaholics, and religion. Being on the internet and can't get off the internet or keep going back to the internet. And simulated gaming. I'm basically talking about a lot of these games where we get on the internet or PlayStation 3 or PlayStation 22, whatever it is that we got out there now. Are examples of that.
What about gambling?
Gambling, yeah, absolutely. That's a process addiction. And I stopped because I ran out of space on the slide, but that's a good one. Thank you. Next one. Okay. Right now, let's turn to what we're here for, and that's looking at lust dependence and sex dependence. And the first order is that to look at is that lust dependence involves the obsession of an overwhelming desire for sexual thoughts. So it's a thought process, okay? And then sexual dependence involves a compulsion to act on the sexual thoughts. Now, interestingly, these are really close to each other. Let me give you an idea. If I get on the internet, as an example, and I can't get off the internet, looking at images, as an example, well, that's an act, okay? It requires an act. I'm actually getting onto something, so I'm doing something. And yet, there's a thought generation, too. So there's lust involved with that, and then there's the sexual dependency, which is there's a compulsion there, which is an act. And then both obsession, which is lust, and compulsion, which is the sexual acts, are usually linked very closely with each other. Process dependence or abuse, things to look at. Obsession is is planning daily events around obtaining the fix. And we mentioned that fix could be gambling and food and all these other things that we talked about earlier under process addictions. But we're going to discuss mainly focus on sex here, okay? So example would be sex, which is where to go. In other words, planning ahead and how to dress for wherever we're going to go. and items needed to engage in that behavior, which might be sexual toys, might be money, you know, to play a part of it, or a computer for that matter. And so anyway, there's a preoccupation with that. Compulsion is feeling that the behavior or fix must occur to satisfy the drive. And if it's not satisfied, the obsession will only escalate and there will be further consuming. Consuming is the thought processes. So just, you know, if I can't get what I need, I've got to focus that much more on it. Okay, next one. Denial. And that is, denial is a way, examples of this would include everyone needs to relax, and of course, sex gratification can lead to relaxation of the body and relief of stress. And then with the stress I'm under, I deserve it. Okay, so kind of a justification, if you will. And then a lot of people get VD, you know, just in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? So, we should look at denial. And you know, sometimes with some people, not everybody, but there can be some other character defects that kind of get in there, like arrogance, and that is, I feel like I deserve it. I've been working my tail off. If you, you know, if you had to work as many hours as I did, you know, you'd understand. And it's almost kind of like we talk through this so that we give ourselves permission to have a bonus, you know, in acting out. Entitlement, thank you. That's a good one. Yeah. Next is looking at guilt and shame. That is, I do things and have been with people I never thought I'd do or be with. Okay. And then I wouldn't do it, and since I'm doing it, I must be one sick piece of fill in the blank, which is right where I was, you know, when I went for help, you know, as an example. So there's a constant beating ourselves or kicking ourselves in the ass in order to it just keeps propagating the guilt, and then the more we do, the worse the guilt gets, and we just get in that little shame guilt cycle that we might have heard about. Next is 10 signs of lust dependence. Now, you know, again, lust and sex are closely linked with each other, so if you want to look at this as 10 signs of lust/sex dependence, and feel free, but because I think it fits for all this personally. One is out of control behavior. And that is, whatever that behavior is, I've got to do a lot more of it as time goes on. Sounds like alcohol and drugs, if you remember the process, I mean the substance dependence. And then escalating dangerousness, and that means, give you some examples. My turn of private situation at home, with, you know, of which I know I'm going to public places, of which I might get arrested, of which I might get on TV, of which I might have a record. Those would be examples of escalating dangerousness, of which also, you know, you combine the two. Let's combine alcohol, because I feel more relaxed and not as guilty when I drink after doing what I've done, and yet over time I find myself drinking and drinking more because the pain is just too much and I'd rather just numb out. So a lot of times process and substance dependence will interlace with each other. Okay, number two are consequences. And if these consequences escalate, and there's compounding consequences. Let's look at that. There's impaired or decreased job performance due to preoccupation or absenteeism. And the way I look at this is an addict is always involved with this aspect, and that is I'm either going up on the drug or I'm coming off the drug. So withdrawal from the drug creates irritability and moodiness and depression and those type of things, the way I handle stress, and so I'm coming down off the drug. And then when I'm coming up on the drug, I may be energized and I may be hyper and I may be hypervigilant, as an example. So number B here is STDs or unwanted pregnancies, and we can throw in abortions in there too. Next would be possible arrests and lewd, lascivious conduct, and that would include the old, you know, meetings at the restroom or at the park or at the, you know, the movie show place. Next would be marital or monogamous relationships are jeopardized or lost. Many of us have faced that reality. Next. Next would be inability to stop and self-perpetuation of behavior once guilt and shame are fused. So I've got to complete the cycle, you know. I've got justification to do what I'm doing, and then I've developed shame for it and feel bad, only I feel toxic shame, so I feel like a piece of eh. And then the guilt keeps picks back up, and with more stress, and I feel the need to have to relieve the stress, and it just keeps on perpetuating itself. Next is self-destructive or high-risk. These are signs of lust. As frequency of using goes up, so too does the need for drama. Okay? And that's where actually even the sexual behavior starts to take on its own life form. And it can be, for example, turning the wife and wanting your wife to act like a prostitute is an example. Or the things that we might do with somebody whose partner gets more and more involved. Sex toys would be an example of that. And anyway, the danger and all that adds up to the rush of it. And as we're trying to continue to seek that high that comes with it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Definition of guilt and shame. I'm not clear on how you understand the difference.
Good question. There is healthy aspects of both of those, and then there's unhealthy parts of those. So shame is feeling dirty, feeling lesser than, feeling not worthy. And so we use the term toxic as shame as an example. So it's like I'm defective. It's not just I have a high sex drive, it's that no, I'm a bad person. And if the public were to find out, then, they would really want to lock me away or just not want to associate with me as an example. That's shame, just feeling dirty, okay? And guilt is the knowledge that I've done something that is, beyond what I view as a normal boundary, or what's healthy, or what other people don't do. Therefore, awareness that I'm guilty of doing something that is wrong. So they're actually closely related to each other, but they're really kind of separate processes. They just feed off of each other. Usually we feel dirty and then we feel guilty that we violated something in the process. Does that kind of make sense? That's a very good question. Yes? Sure.
Guilt is, at least as I'm trying to define, guilt is I made a mistake.
Yeah, and there's healthy sides of both of those, and the healthy manifestations of shame is humility, and that is, in other words, if we've gotten help for our issues, whatever they are, then I have a healthy humility, not only that, I did do those things, but I'm not that person anymore. See, I don't feel guilty anymore about it. I've already dealt with my guilt. I've already asked for forgiveness. I've already worked my steps. And so I don't have to beat myself anymore. I'm a good person. I become a good person. I like to live on the healthy side of both of those. But there's still the guilt. It just means I have an awareness of what I've done in the past. I'm glad I can say in the past instead of present. All right, number five is an effort or desire to limit the sexual behavior, whatever that is, and limit sexual behavior to only certain types. Maybe President Clinton and is an example, and that oral sex is not sex. I mean, we all kind of joke about that or jest about it, but there's a justification that that's not really sex because that would be an example of that. Or masturbation's okay because I'm not hurting anybody, as an example. Or I may pick certain partners. Interestingly, some sex addicts look at it that if I'm having sex with a prostitute, that's not really associated with love, so I can kind of blow that off as not being about feelings involved other than just a need to get gratification and get, the relaxation that comes with that. And so that may be another sort of way of limiting things or limiting it to certain partners as an example. All right, next is six is sexual obsession or fantasy, and that is when things are uncomfortable or problematic. There is a mental place that sex addicts go. And that is basically where we're looking for relief. Next is increased amounts, and that is equivalent to development of tolerance. And the desire to achieve the same effect can only be reached with increased frequency, intensity of the acts, etc. Okay, next. Number eight is our mood swings. And as sex is used to to as a fix to alter bad mood states. And with bad mood states, we talked about is irritability, moodiness, impaired sleep, and reacting to situations. Rage is another example of this, and being impatient with others are another manifestation of that. And anyway, the shame and guilt kind of feed on that. Next is increased time, similar to the substance dependence, and that is just basically preoccupation with obtaining, using, and recovering from those sexual fixes. Next is neglect, and that is as the disease progresses, so does the pervasiveness of the neglect. You know, for me, it would be, you know, my children and my wife the most. Then I've denied taking good care of myself, and then I denied friendships, healthy friendships, and my God, and it just kept expanding. Okay. Cyber sex dependence. Okay. And criteria of problematic online sexual behavior. I'll try not to get explicit for anybody here, and I apologize if I've already said anything that was inappropriate with anybody here. Number one, preoccupation with sex on the internet. It's an obsession. Okay, thought process. And engaging in sex on the internet more often or for longer periods of time than intended. That's a compulsion because there's an act there. Act of getting on the internet, act of staying on the internet, act of connecting with whatever you want to connect to, act potentially for sexual relief as an example. Number three is repeated unsuccessful efforts to control or cut back on or stop engaging in sex on the internet, the compulsion. Number four would be restlessness or irritability when attempting to limit or stop engaging in sex on the internet. There's the mental mood altering aspects of things. Number five would be using sex on the internet as a way of escaping from problems or relieving feelings such as helplessness, guilt, anxiety, or depression. There's usually denial involved with that. Returning to sex on the internet day after day in search of more intense or higher risk sexual experience, compulsion, you know, the act of. And in this case, it may just be looking at things that you wouldn't ever thought you would possibly look at. As an example, I'm just going to leave it at that. And then lying to family members, therapists, and others to conceal involvement with sex on the internet, which involves denial, shame, and guilt. And number one, I don't want to get turned in for something I was doing. Number two is I don't want to get rejected or judged by the therapist. Number three, I don't want to set myself up where my family members would, you know, my therapist would want my family members to be brought in for us to deal with it openly. So as a result, that would be a reason to stay in that sort of denial and control, you know, what goes on with the therapist. And just as with a doctor, I can't help a patient if they're not disclosing to me, they're holding back. The same thing's true with the therapist in this situation. And please be aware, as far as I'm concerned, all of us have denial, even about healthy things, and actually that God gives us that as a defense mechanism, as a survival thing. Just one moment. I remember going to treatment, and of all things, my roommate was a psychiatrist. And that's all I needed was to be analyzed by my roommate. So we're going to my very first meeting in recovery, and it's an AA meeting, and we were on the way there, and I said, you know, I'm just so tired of keeping everything secret. I want to finally let everything out, and I believe somebody could help me if I just, you know, tell the truth. And he says, well, you don't have control over that. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, denial. I said, what are you talking about? I'm here, I'm tired of living a life of secrets. And he says, Daryl, you don't have any control over that. Denial. I said, what are you talking about? He said, Daryl, denial is a God-given mechanism to hold off, you know, your emotional pain, physical pain that you've had in your life, of which you end up acting out in the process. And I said, I know, but if I start talking about it, they can help me to break down the denial. He said, they don't have control over that. And I said, then what the hell am I supposed to do? And he said, well, that's up to God. And I do believe that after it was all said and done, I believe God worked through the therapist to help me to open up those windows and doors so that I could see things that I couldn't see before. I'll also say the beautiful thing is that many years later, that God gets me to see things even many, many years later that I didn't see before, despite many, many hundreds of hours of therapy along the way. So, just keeping an open mind about open doors is probably good for me. Number eight is committing illegal sexual acts online, for example, sending or downloading pornography or soliciting illegal acts online. That involves compulsion and guilt. And next is jeopardizing or losing a significant relationship, job, educational or career opportunity because of online sexual behavior. And number 10 is incurring significant financial consequences as a result of engaging in online sexual behavior. Okay. Now, I'm going to break this down. We're going to get to the other part of this. If you recall, I'm trying to correlate substance dependence with process dependence. And the bottom line is, it's all about the brain. And some people say our brain's down here, but no, I'm going to say actually we're going to talk about the brain up here. It's a joke. All right, so I'm going to use a term, but then I'm going to try to explain it again in terms that I can understand. And that is that sexual activity centers on the release of brain chemicals. Okay, and it's the release of those chemicals that get whatever desired effect we want. Turns out those same chemical releases are involved with methamphetamines and cocaine and sniffing paint and taking alcohol and everything else. So it's actually all the same stuff. First one is an example would be dopamine, and this particular release of dopamine is as powerful as doing cocaine or methamphetamines. And we have an awesome scan of the brain. Vanderbilt did it actually, of people doing cocaine and doing a brain activity of what parts of the brain were stimulated from doing cocaine, and then they did it with the sex addict, you know, watching pornography. Turned out the exact same area were lit up, and that's just an example of the use of these chemicals in the brain. I think it's important to relate that it helped me with shame and guilt in regard to brain chemistry, and here's why. I thought it was all a moral problem for me, you know, that I was just a bad person and all that. And my point is that when I started to recognize that these chemicals were in my brain and I'm not responsible for them being up there, and then the traumas I wasn't responsible for that happened in my life, and then I was a setup that sure enough I was in the right place or wrong place at the wrong time involving whatever my addiction might be, that sure enough that cascade of events would stimulate these chemicals to be released and have some wonderful effects. And that I had a need to keep going back to get those effects. And my point being is it helped me with my guilt and shame because I wasn't responsible for any of that process being set up to begin with. It's like we were kind of pre-programmed, if you will. That was a matter of time. Now, it's not always a matter of time. I'll give you an idea. There are millions and millions of alcoholics in the United States, but they never have, those millions and millions that don't know it, for a lot of them, they never had a drink. So they don't know they're alcoholic. Okay, as an example. And so sometimes we're pre-programmed to be an addict, but we didn't do our substance of choice to get these chemicals released, and as a result, by the grace of God, they didn't go down that road of having to suffer through it. Anyway, this chemical and dopamine, if you go to the second part of this, is that this? It's a primitive emotional region of the brain called the limbic system. I'm not going to get more technical than just naming the system, but God gave us this. Mammals have it, and this limbic system is important for all primitive drives. I don't know why we have to use primitive. It sounds shaming, but it's not meant to be shaming. It's just saying we have some basic drives is a better way to put that. And that would be the need for food, the need for water, the need for temperature. So if it's cold, I want to get warm. If it's warm, I want to get cooler, as an example. The need for sleep and the need for sex would be examples. You know, God gave us those drives. You know, they're not, you cannot modify those. They're meant to be there. As I said, if God wanted us all to be hermits, there wouldn't be any more human beings because we die off and that'd be the end of that. Next one is dopamine in the addiction. Sexual arousal is a basic instinctual motivation, and whether through fantasy that brings us pleasure or through the actual sexual acts themselves, dopamine prints a deep reward in our psyche. The hunger, which we use the term cravings, to act out the behavior will release even more dopamine. Now, this isn't necessarily set up as a negative thing, okay, because it's just that, you know, quote, normal people with normal sexual behavior and normal sexual thoughts, you know, we're programmed to have that happen, which is that when we do it, it's a good thing and makes us feel great and all this, and later we want to do it again. It's just that in the addict, this is on hyperdrive, basically. And so there's a need to get into lust that eventually leads to acting out. Yes, sir.
What are the implications of this for, quote, I'm sober when I'm going to look at porn on the internet? I mean, you know, if I read this right, this there's the same effect on your brain as a quote acting out.
Yes.
You know, that's a false distinction. It's chemically,
yes,
in the brain.
Yeah, and there's some denial involved with that, you know, in general, and that is, if I, you know, if I was a sex addict and I, you know, didn't do porn before, if you will, pornography, and then so all acting out was actually person to person, as an example, and then I, you know, got sober, and then later I got into pornography, but I didn't touch anything, you know, in my body, as an example, then the idea is that, you know, let's just say it's playing with fire, it's the bottom line. That's the same justification an alcoholic has who loves vodka or whiskey, and so they start drinking near beer, as an example. And then later they drink just beer. And then later they drink whiskey with milk in it, as an example, you know. You know, it's just like playing with fire. If you play with fire, you may not get burned. But if you play with fire long enough, there's a good chance you're going to get burned. All right, serotonin and addiction. This is there's three main chemicals here to talk about, and we're almost done here. That is that low serotonin levels are tied with cravings for sex, and sexual acts release more serotonin in our brain. And so low serotonin is associated with alcohol dependence. So they get low levels, and then alcohol seems to release more serotonin.
So basically what you're saying with the serotonin levels, if we're releasing this chemical in our head, and the more we release it, the more we want it.
Yes.
And so when we cut back on that drive, then we start feeling the effects of the lower serotonin, so we want to do something.
There you go. You got it. That's exactly right. Whew. I was hoping I wasn't getting through. Thank you. Because, I mean, this stuff's kind of tough. Anyway, low serotonin levels are associated with, well, withdrawal effects from not doing sex in a sex addict. Let's look at it. Fatigue, irritability, moodiness, depression, and obsessive compulsive behavior. So in other words, I may have to work on other things to occupy my mind and, you know, get fixated on those type of things to try to stay away from doing what I don't want to do. And all these are common in alcohol dependence as well as sexual dependence, and it's also true with other substance dependences. SSRI agents, now that's a technical term, okay, but the term would be Prozac, Paxil, Surzone, Effexor, Cymbalta, Zoloft, Lexapro, and the newest one, Prestique. So anyway, all three of these are called stimulatory antidepressants. And we're not stimulating sexual drive, we're stimulating certain hormone releases, serotonin specifically, okay, here, trying to get the levels up. And interestingly, they treat depression, but they also treat obsessive compulsive disorders. So, you know, no, SSRIs are not the cure for sex addiction, or less addiction. But I'm just saying is that there are doctors such as myself who may utilize those type of products because they can help a patient. And please don't get me wrong. I need to state that before we go to the next slide, I need to state that my belief in regard to recovery for an addict is this. If a person like me is involved, let's say with alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling, I don't really care about the addiction, but I mean the dependence or whatever, but is I believe my role is about 5% of the big picture there. And I believe that therapy is 95% of the benefit for the patient. The answers are in the 95%, not the 5%, okay? That doesn't mean a person may not be severely depressed and I've got to assist them with the depression because the depression is blocking their ability to be present for therapy. Now, what's therapy? 12-step group, y'all being in here, me calling my accountability partner, having a lunch with a friend who's in recovery, seeing a therapist for individual counseling, a 12-step meeting. I mean, it's just that, you know, therapy is therapy. It's basically talking about life and trying to find answers and being vulnerable and you know, asking for help, basically. So I want to make real clear that we'll talk about things like this, and it's like, oh, I just need to call my doctor. I need to get on one of them SSRIs. Let me go write it down. It ain't going to take care of the sex addiction, but it may assist in recovery. All right, next is endorphins and addiction. Endorphins, it's kind of termed kind of the pain drug. So in other words, if I broke my leg right now, you know, I'm in intense pain, but a lot of times a little bit later I'm not in quite as intense pain. And part of that shock, admittedly, but part of it's also that God has released these natural hormones in my body, in my brain, to help reduce the pain level. So the pain's still there, it's just not as intense as it originally was. Example for me would be playing basketball and getting a bad sprain. I may be writhing in pain on the ground for 3 to 5 minutes. Then I go sit on the bench over there, and then it's swelling and bleeding in there and doing its thing. But then 10 minutes later, I just feel like it feels like it aches, and that's all. Well, I got a bad sprain down here, and I can't play hoops for the next 2 to 4 weeks. But the bottom line is, endorphins are just nailing my brain and relieving me of that effect. Well, endorphins also have another effect, and that is if we took endorphins and gave it to everybody right now, we'd get really high. You know, we just get really pumped up. So like the Titans getting ready today, or whoever, and that's cool. We as spectators are getting excited about the game, whether it's going to be on TV, you know, tonight or something like that, or talking to our buddies about it or something like that. That's it. You know, endorphins kind of get us pumped up, if you will, or excited, raises heartbeat, raises heart rate, has a sweat, raises us breathing more, et cetera. But anyway, it also is related to sex. So let's look at endorphins and addiction. And then it's sexual images, pornography, and an increase in pornographic films and magazines often accompany sex addiction, with material of a more hardcore nature being sought to satisfy the addiction. Along with this, masturbation is will usually become more frequent and more spontaneous, and it develops, as do most addictions, as the more you have, the more you need. And as sex causes a release of these endorphins, the kind of the high, if you will, if you want to look at climax, would be an example of what endorphins are going crazy. We get the feel for those good chemicals, and sex addicts believe they experience frequent highs from their addiction. And the truth is that once an addiction is developed, it becomes more and more difficult to satisfy those cravings, so it's harder to get that high again. And endorphin release produces similar effects with cocaine or methamphetamines, but other ways of looking at it, endorphins are also released when we exercise. It's a feel-good thing. You know, for 2 weeks I feel like crap. If I'm out of shape and I start exercising, I feel horrible. I'm tired all the time, I'm irritable, can't sleep well. But you know, about 2-4 weeks later, I keep exercising, I actually start feeling good about exercising. And that's actually endorphins. And actually later, then I actually get excited that I'm going to go work out, as an example. And anyway, also pain, as we mentioned, will release endorphins. And even some simple things like hug therapy. That feel-good effect, if you will. All right, last slide. Is that summarizing things, lust dependence, and throwing their sex dependence, involves the obsession of an overwhelming desire for sexual thoughts. Okay, so thought processes and obsession. And then sexual dependence involves a compulsion to act on the sexual thoughts. So whether I'm getting on the internet, doing something physically here, or something physical in other parts of my body. Next would be both the obsession, lust, and compulsion. The sexual acts are usually linked close together. In other words, it's hard to separate the two. Like substance dependence, lust and sex dependence result in shame, guilt, out-of-control behavior, negative consequences, and despite the negative consequences, inability to stop, and high-risk behavior that gets more and more high-risk with time. And that the brain chemistry responses to process dependences are very similar to those of substance dependence. So they include lust and sex, as well as opiates, alcohol, cocaine, and methamphetamines. Any questions? Yes?
The American Medical Society doesn't recognize sex addiction as a disease as of yet.
Right. So does the American Psychiatric Association also does not, and the American Society of Addiction Medicine also does not. But, you know, all I can say is ignorance abounds, and I'm testament to the to that. And, you know, I mean, that's my opinion, okay? But the reality is that it is sad that the you know, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is where I'm certified through, it's the largest organization of addiction specialists in the United States and the world. Lo and behold, you know, I went to the international conference through 3 years ago, and so I called them on the phone and I said, "So I saw y'all's itinerary of talks. Are y'all got anything on like eating disorders or sex addiction or something like that?" And they said, "Oh no, no, we're alcohol and drugs. You know, we're substance. You know, really." And I got off the phone and I was really angry with that, and talked to my other addiction doctors, and they said, "Well, you're right. They're slow in coming around." So then, you know, they got this criteria in the American Psychiatric Association that is sexual disorder NOS. What the heck that means, I don't know. But I mean, actually, they define it, but it just doesn't really nail a sexual dependence like alcohol dependence and alcohol abuse, and like we use the other terms. So, I mean, sex addicts, I know, as well as, you know, my personal life, I can go straight down the list of the things that were on that thing and say, oh yeah, I more than met the criteria, and other people I know and my accountability partners more than meet the criteria. That's what matters to me. And so, you know, I take it just as seriously as, you know, I took my own personal life when I see someone else and ask them for help. And the reality is that the medical community is slow to come around to recognize that. They look at it as a compulsive behavior and an obsession. And yes, it's true, it's an obsessive compulsive behavior, but it doesn't have, I mean, you know, thinking of the number three or not being, you know, there are so many other activities that involve obsessive compulsive behavior, like cleaning the house or something like that, that may not have near the suffering consequences of sex addiction, especially on a societal level. You know, and I don't want to offend anybody who's had obsessive compulsive disorder, because some of those people have had sickness bad enough that they're totally demoralized and can't be functional. You know, so
how long does it take for the brain for the brain chemistry to adjust from sobriety?
Interestingly, it's about the same for process addictions as well as substance dependence, and that is depends on who you ask. So, what I've been told, and I believe is true, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay. As you know, many people have a problem with the concept of addiction for things that involve personal choice, especially but not limited to a religious community. How would you explain it to someone who has a problem with the concept of addiction that involves something, a behavior that was initiated based on the person's personal choice to, for example, sexual behaviors or drug, how would you explain it to that?
Is that trying to explain it to a non-addict as an example? Because that's kind of what I thought you were getting at. Well, good luck. I mean, that's the right answer, but I'll try to answer your question, because I'm not trying to make fun of you. I mean, it's a tough question. You know, the reality is that to a non-addict, you know, they talk about us being from Mars or, you know, from wherever, and, you know, they're earthlings or whatever. I think there's some truth to that. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And that is me trying to explain to somebody, you know, my dad's alcoholism and, you know, dying from alcoholism, to a non-addict, that just doesn't make sense. You know, you just stop, you know. And I promise you that there are people in our fellowship with long-term sobriety who, when they went to treatment, there were no sex addiction treatment centers, so they went to an A&D treatment center, and the doctor said, "Well, yeah, but you drink a lot, and you also are doing, you know, opiates and all that. You know, let's focus on that." "Well, yeah, but you don't understand. I do this other behavior over here," and over, whether it's Talbot, whether it's Sierra Tucson, I mean, some of the premier institutions in the United States, their response in the 80s and into the 90s was, "Well, just don't do that." I swear to God, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Yeah, and you know, I wish it was that simple, but the point is that it undermines the, for lack of a better term, ignorance within the medical profession in regard to the seriousness of this disorder. But no offense, the same thing's true with alcoholism and opiate dependence. I go across the state giving talks on the overprescribing habits of opiates by doctors in the United in the state of Tennessee, with the third prescriber, with the third most prescribing painkiller state in the United States. But the reality is this: if you ask a doctor what is the average period of time that you spent in medical school in addiction training, okay? And we asked this actually from addiction doctors at a major conference I went to. We introduced ourselves, what we did for a living, and then how much time was spent in education. And in 4 years, we have to recognize medical school is year-round. And you also have to recognize it's a Monday through Monday deal. I mean, there is no days off, because you're studying with other times, and you know, like for me, I stayed till midnight practically for four straight years. And they made the comment that on first day, the dean came in, he said, you're going to learn so much information in the next 4 years that if you stack the books just against each other, not stacking them up, but, you know, just hard, flat on each other, that you're going to learn information that's in the textbooks that will go up three stories. And I felt overwhelmed, but the reality was 4 years later, I knew it was in those books. But the bottom line is, with all of that, I'm not trying to impress you. What I'm saying is, I said that to say this. What is the average period of time of all those addiction doctors in all the different medical schools, because all over the country, the answer in addiction training, and the answer was between 0 and 1 year. Okay? I mean, 0 and 1 hour. So my point is that you're asking a doctor to treat a condition of which we're not qualified. And the whole purpose of the Developing the American Society of Addiction Medicine is beginning the process. You know, like SA, you know, didn't exist too many years ago. Well, guess what? Treatment centers didn't understand this disease whatsoever. And most of them don't still to this day. But the bottom line, most of them don't want to deal with process addictions. I mean, if it's just food, as an example, they can't handle it. But the reality is, it's not hopeless. There are centers all over the country who do manage these conditions. And there are addiction doctors that are God gave us to kind of help us to help ourselves. Yes. Let me go right here next, because he had his hand up a minute ago. Yes, sir.
Do you know of any physical evidence or studies that would back up the AA literature in terms of the allergy of the body? That regarding our brain chemistry, is our brain chemistry different in which we have comes out as an allergy that calls for more once you start the process?
You're asking a great question. I don't know any literature on the subject. I will say this. In my recovery, including the time I was actually inpatient, we went to everything. We went to AA meetings and NA meetings and CODA meetings and OA meetings. We went to everything. And one thing, they were trying to see if we had anything else that we were actually willing to own so we can get some help over there. But the bottom line is, I mean, when I got out from treatment, 4 months of that deal, I did the 300 hours of therapy that took about 3.5 years after I got out on top of that. But the bottom line is, I went to a whole lot of meetings, a whole lot of meetings. But the reality is, later I settled into going to AA meetings. Well, I'm not an alcoholic. So how do I qualify? Well, if I got a desire not to drink, then I qualify to go in the door. But the reality is, what was I getting there? What I was getting there was, they really seemed to have nailed relationships. They seemed to nail, life on life's terms. They had a lot of understanding about things I had no clue about, and I didn't necessarily get from another fellowship as much of. So my attitude is, we all only have one challenge in life, and that is to, how do we find out how we get our legitimate needs met? And if that means being open-minded enough that I'm willing to go into different groups and try to figure out what my needs are, I'm not going to step into a room where it's a closed meeting and I don't qualify to be in the meeting, so don't get me wrong. But to try to answer your question, the bottom line is, everything I've read in the AA literature nails me in regard to the drug of choice, which may be a process issue. Good question. Yes, sir.
Just to help me get wrap my mind around all of this, and especially what you talked about today, it would be helpful if I had your PowerPoint. Would you be willing to share that with you? Share that with us?
You're asking a great question. I think I'm being asked to, I've got a DVD here, and I'm asked to give the DVD to the people who copy everything out there so that it could be distributed, not only to this meeting, but also to the country. So I'm not saying no, it's just that it's probably better for me to respect the fact they gave me an opportunity to talk here, and that I need to be able to work through them.
Buy the DVD.
Yeah, and it'll be in the section over here after I give it back to them. They just have to copy it. I'll give it to them as soon as this meeting's over. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make
4 minutes.
A quick statement about the medical profession and how it handled me. I
hit my rock bottom. I confessed everything to my wife about what I had done to her and my compulsion and obsession. She kicked me out of the house. My sister said, come up to me in Boston. I took a train. I got off the train, overnight train, got off in the morning. Two of my sisters picked me up and took me to a psychiatric hospital.
Yes.
Two women psychiatrists came out and evaluated me. I had been reading Patrick Carnes, got halfway through Out of the Shadows, identified with everything in it. I had been drinking a lot for about a year and a half, and I was depressed. These two psychiatrists said, I told them my whole story, how I abused my wife and my compulsion on the internet. And they said, so how much do you drink? I said, you know, I drink a couple drinks a day, maybe three. And they said, well, it sounds like you're suffering from alcoholism and depression. I said, well, what about the sexual? You know, this is like, this is what really governs my life. I've only been heavily drinking for about a year. I've been doing this behavior for decades. They said, you're not a sex addict. You don't know what a sex addict is. A sex addict will lock themselves up in a room for days, masturbate 20, 30 times a day, solicit children, expose themselves, you know, to everyone in the world, get arrested. You're not a sex addict. I walked out of there. They said, throw that book away. I listened to them. I threw the book away. I went to rehab for a week, came out, was going to AA. 10 days later, I walked into an SA room, and I finally felt like I was home.
Yes.
There you go.
Amen. We'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Prior to the 30s, alcoholism wasn't seen as a disease.